This is Vermont Law School's Environmental Hot Topics podcast. Vermont Law School's environmental programs have offered lectures from distinguished scholars, practitioners, activists, and public leaders for over a decade. Today, we bring the Vermont Law School Hot Topic Lecture Series to the web and to the world. My name is Rebecca Purdom, Assistant Dean for Environmental Programs at Vermont Law School. Today, we'll hear from Robin Cundis Craig. Professor Craig joined us at Vermont as the Distinguished Scholar in Sustainable Agriculture and Food Systems. She's the William H. Leary Professor of Law at the University of Utah's J.S. Quinney School of Law. Professor Craig's research has covered a myriad of water issues, including the influence of climate change on freshwater resources and the intersection of water and energy law. She's the author of 9 books, countless book chapters and articles, on issues from water law, sustainability, climate change, and environmental protection. She has served on 3 consecutive National Research Council committees on the Clean Water Act and the Mississippi River. And when she's not teaching, writing books, or speaking, Professor Craig is working as a research consultant to the Environmental Defense Fund and serving on the American Bar Association's section on environment, energy, and natural resources. So thank you for joining us today, Robin.
Great to be here.
So if you look at your biography, you really are a person who's concentrated in the environment and in clean water resources and in climate change. And yet we've brought you to Vermont Law School this summer to be the agricultural scholar. So first of all, can you tell us how the agricultural world intersects with your previous scholarly endeavors?
Well, a lot of my work has always been in ocean and coastal law, and in particular on how to protect the world's coral reefs. And that led me into realizing how much food that coral reefs and other ocean systems provide for the inhabitants of the world. And so that's the real connection, because oceans are affected by water issues, freshwater issues, and food supply is affected by the ocean, so it all ties together.
Well, and one of the issues you're talking about now is food security. Maybe before we go into the oceans piece, you can just give us a definition of food security. What is food security?
Okay, well, in general, food security refers to the state of having secure access to enough food for a given population at all times. So who's in charge is usually a government, and how you define the population you're trying to serve is important when you're talking about food security as a policy measure. But basically, we want to have enough food of the right quality and nutrition for everybody all the time.
And typically, when we talk about food security, at least in the United States and in kind of international contexts, we're typically talking about land-based crops, right?
That's the usual context, and a lot of the measures of food security are based on the staples, wheat, soybeans, corn. But that ignores the fact that a whole lot of the world's population depends on fish and other products of the ocean as their primary source of protein.
And so how are those fisheries doing? I mean, where are we in food security if we're looking at fish populations?
In a very bad place. Most of the world's commercial fish stocks have crashed, are crashing, are overfished, or in a very optimistic light are at capacity. Very few of them are underdeveloped. Crashed for the world's definition of a commercial fishery means that the fish stock is at less than 10% of its baseline. So it's a little scary that we're there for so many commercial fisheries. And there's a very scary projection that came out in Science magazine that basically all commercially fish stocks would be crashed by about 2053.
Wow.
So, now that doesn't mean the fish go extinct. You can have small fisheries, there will be a few of them around, but it also tends to ignore the fact that those baselines are usually turn of the 20th century or maybe World War II, and there's a lot of evidence that those fish populations were already drastically reduced from natural by the time anyone started paying attention. So, our wild fish are in bad shape for the most part.
You cited commercial fisheries. What's a commercial fishery?
kind of whatever the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations defines it to be. But in general, you can think about the big factory ships going out into the ocean and catching tons and tons of fish all at once. Some commercial fisheries are a lot smaller than that. But it's the people who are going out to catch fish to sell on a large scale to other people rather than to eat for themselves or their immediate family.
So when I go out with my fly rod onto the White River and catch two trout for supper, that's not part of the commercial fisheries that we're talking about today.
No. You might be included in a recreational fishery. You might be included in a subsistence fishery. But no, that's not what we mean by a commercial fishery.
But the commercial fisheries are the ones you said that are collapsing or crashing. That is really where the bulk of the protein is going out to feed a large portion of the world. Who's eating fish?
Lots of people. It's for about 1 billion people in the world, their primary source of protein. For up to 4.3 billion people, it's a significant source of protein. Now, some of this is freshwater fish. Not all of these fish dependencies are on commercial fish, and that's important to note that in a lot of countries it still is artisanal or subsistence fishing. But what commercial fisheries do is mean that the country that catches the fish isn't necessarily the country that's eating the fish. So, for example, the United States imports something like 85 to 90% of the fish that consumers here buy, but the fish that we catch actually ends up going someplace else because our consumers like the rarer and more expensive forms of fish from the sea, and so we send other fish to other places. So it's part of the global market in food. Mm-hmm. And that's an important aspect of food security too, is if you don't have control over the source of your food in any sense, mm-hmm. not just fish, you are less secure than if you're raising it at home.
Is the United States a net importer or exporter of fish, or does it really matter when we look at global protein sources?
We are actually about even. We import a ton of what we eat, but we also export a ton of what we don't eat to other people. So last I heard, we're about even. And it does matter in places where fish is a significant source of protein. I'm focusing on protein because that's one of the measures of how healthy a population is if it's getting enough protein. And in the United States, fish isn't that high a percentage of where most people get their protein. It matters to certain communities, like in certain indigenous communities in the Northwest or Alaska. It's very important too, but overall, it's not as important to us. In Africa, it's a huge source of protein. If most Africans are not getting fish, they're probably not getting enough protein. So that's an important issue with the food security, is what other substitutes do you have?
So if these fisheries are being overfished, who governs these fisheries? Who governs who gets to fish?
That is based on two levels of governance. At the international law level, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea governs who has jurisdiction over what parts of the ocean. And under the third of these conventions, which is the most recent one, it was adopted in 1982, went into force in 1994, they've got some very complex jurisdictional provisions over how much of the ocean any coastal nation can control. The most important one for fisheries is that coastal nations can claim a 200-mile exclusive economic zone off of their coasts. And within that exclusive economic zone, they can control fisheries. So the United States is not a party to the treaty, although we agree with the 200-mile exclusive economic zone. We were one of the first countries to assert one. We used that authority to basically kick out foreign fishers and said, you have to be U.S. flag vessel to fish in our waters. Other countries, however, use that authority to actually license foreign fishers to come in and fish their water. So that's the international law. You can control 200 nautical miles. But then the next level is, once you've asserted that control, what are you actually doing with it? And so in the United States, we have the 1976 Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act, which was amended significantly in the 1990s to try and put in sustainable provisions for fishing. A lot of countries have virtually nothing as far as effective fisheries management is concerned. They may have laws on the books, but enforcing out at sea is even more difficult than enforcing on land. So, those are the two levels. International law gives you 200 miles, then whatever the country decides to do with it, up to the country. Beyond the 200 miles is known as the high seas, and the basic rule for the high seas is freedom of the seas. So unless there's some other treaty in force, basically open fishing on the high seas.
Go for it.
Go for it.
You said that within the United States and other countries, within their territorial waters, they enforce some kind of law that says fishing must be sustainable. What does that mean?
Well, that's the question of the hour. As the world statistics indicate, we haven't achieved sustainable fishing by any definition of sustainability. The United States has been trying hard. A basic definition would be that you would leave enough fish of reproductive size in the water to produce enough fish that you could keep catching the same amount every year for eternity. All evidence is we're not there. There are enormous pressures on fisheries managers to let fishers catch fish.
What does the United States say a sustainable yield would be? Do they manage it fishery by fishery? Do they manage it by geography, this cove versus that cove? How does the regulation work?
It actually is a little bit geographic and a little bit fishery by fishery. So we have fishery management councils that are set up on a regional basis.
And when you say fisheries, when we use that word, we mean like by species.
By species.
Okay.
Yeah, it's mostly by species. There are some fisheries that are co-managed because you're catching two or three species simultaneously and there's no real way to divide them up. But yeah, usually it's species by species. Usually on a regional level, usually at the Magnuson-Stevens Act applies to federal waters in the United States, so that would be more than 3 miles out to sea. States are usually responsible for fisheries within 3 miles, and there's some complicated provisions for coordinating state and federal regulations. And the federal government, nor the states, manage all fisheries. They manage the fisheries they suspect are in need of management. So there are a amazingly high number of fish stocks that we know people are fishing, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration will still tell you that we don't actually know what the state of the fish stock is. So it can seem a little random at some points.
So if we can't manage our wild fish stocks successfully, or we're not sure about it, or we're depleting them, or we don't have enough fish out there in the ocean, why don't we grow it ourselves? We don't chase wild wheat and wild cows. We grow wheat and we grow cows. So can we grow fish?
We can, and we have been. And it's called aquaculture most generally. But that's a general term. It applies to both freshwater and saltwater. If you're talking about saltwater fisheries, it's usually called mariculture. And we do a lot of culture. China is the absolute world leader in aquaculture. China's been aquaculturing fish for thousands of years. They tend to like carp. But there's an amazing amount of species that are aquacultured in some form across the world. I think it's over 200 different species, including shellfish and some seaweeds that are aquacultured around the world. They're not all the same, and that's where talking about aquaculture and mariculture as a policy matter gets to be very interesting.
Before we get to that, can you just describe what this looks like? Is it a I'm managing kiddie pools full of trout. What does an aquaculture or mariculture facility look like? How is this done?
It kind of depends on the species. So if you're talking about a fish, whether it's freshwater or saltwater, you've got it in some sort of contained big tank or net system of some sort. Now, there are some kinds of fish you can aquaculture in contained facilities. You don't actually have to put them in a natural stream or out in the ocean themselves. It looks like big tanks of fish is what it looks like. Their feeding apparatus, there's ways to treat them with antibiotics. The fish are swimming around in something.
It's like the fish farms we visited as kids.
Right.
You throw, food at the top and all the fish come up to eat.
Yeah, exactly. And you pull them out when they're big enough to eat. The ones that are of more concern to people are the in situ aquaculture facilities where you're actually putting your nets. It's usually a net pen of some sort or sometimes a plastic, more solid structure that allows water to flow through. But again, you need something usually to contain them that are either sitting in a river or sitting offshore. And some of these can be the aquatic equivalent of concentrated animal feeding operations. You mentioned cows. Well, that's a big issue with cows. It can be a big issue with fish. Under the Clean Water Act, they're called the confined aquatic animal production facilities.
And just to be clear for our listeners, the big problem there is to be in delicate poop, right?
Yep, same with fish. You're holding a whole bunch of fish, sometimes millions at a time, over a very small space, and their feces go to the bottom, and they collect on the bottom, and they basically kill everything else living on the bottom. So that's a huge environmental concern with certain types of aquaculture and mariculture both, is too many fish in too small a space, and the surrounding environment can't handle the waste.
If you could deal with the waste problem, we could, get a manure pen for the fish waste. I'm not sure how that would happen, but presume you could deal with that problem. This seems to be less impactful agriculture than putting cows on a field or cutting down trees for a livestock or for cropland. Are there other environmental impacts that come out of aquaculture in some ways, other than just the feces load?
Yes, there are. They are fed food. And this is where the type of species you're aquaculturing can make a big difference, because a lot of aquaculture, especially in the United States, has been salmon aquaculture, mostly Atlantic salmon aquaculture, and they are carnivores. So what you end up doing is feeding these fish meal and fish oil. And so if you're worried about not harming the wild stocks further, you are raising the wrong fish, because it takes somewhere between about 2.6 and 5 pounds of wild fish to produce 1 pound of farm salmon. So you're making the problem worse, basically. That's one environmental concern. Another environmental concern is whenever you're keeping animals in confinement, you've got to worry about disease, which means you're feeding them antibiotics, which means the antibiotics are getting into the water, which means you're exposing other critters to the antibiotics. And there's some evidence that aquaculture can lead to antibiotic-resistant bacteria and other disease vectors that can then infect human beings. This is already a huge problem with antibiotics. We don't need extra help from aquaculture. You're giving them concentrated food. If you're not careful about how much you feed these animals, that food can get out into the environment. It's basically another form of nutrient pollution. If you're raising a non-native species, they can escape their pens. This has been a problem in Chile. It's a real concern with salmon, especially now that it looks like we might have some genetically modified salmon about to go into the world.
What happens when that happens? If an aquaculture fish jumps out of its pen and gets to run away with the wild pack, what are the potential problems? I mean, I hear possible disease, but otherwise it's a fish is a fish, right? A salmon is a salmon.
Nope. Salmon, not a salmon. As anyone who's done the Endangered Species Act work for salmon in the United States will tell you. No, incredibly not the same species. And there's a risk that you'll get interbreeding. There's a risk that you'll dilute the wild populations. When you're dealing with a species where distinct populations segments and genetic differences are important to whether they're protected or not, which is true with salmon, any dilution of those genetics is potentially harmful to the wild salmon stocks that are already so depleted. And don't discount the disease either. Salmon in particular can get sea lice, which, like most diseases, is much easier to get when you're concentrated, but then once you escape into the wild, you can spread it to the entire wild population. And that was a huge problem with salmon farming in Chile, among other places. So, yeah, a lot of other risks from aquaculture.
Potential risks. Are the fish, I think of fish being kept in confinement, I think of the stories we always heard about zoos, where there's a lion in the zoo, the lion got out, and the rest of the lions were much stronger and beat up on the poor zoo lion, and the zoo lion couldn't keep up with the rest of the wild animals. You say that there's a risk of interbreeding, for example, but would wild salmon have anything to do with the domestic salmon, or would they look at it as...
Apparently they do. This is something biologists worry about. I will take them at their word that apparently they do. Now, the weakness, it gets interesting on the consumer side, because one of the reasons people like to eat salmon is because they spend so much of their life having to be strong swimmers. They develop the flesh and the flavor that makes them popular, and that actually is a consumer problem with aquaculture salmon, is they just kind of sit and swim in circles. They don't develop that meat that mm-hmm. people want, and they have to be dosed so that they're right colors and not a pasty gray. And there's some interesting issues that come up. But, you know, salmon aquaculture is at one end of a very wide spectrum. From an environmental perspective, I think it's very hard to justify salmon aquaculture in terms of food security, mm-hmm. Especially. But at the other end of the spectrum, you have an emerging set of species that are being grown in the sea, which are the filter feeders, the clams, the oysters, the shellfish. And they actually turn out are great for the environment. They don't need fish protein. They live off of plankton for the most part. They filter out nutrient pollution, so you're actually improving your water quality if you grow these. They provide habitat for various areas. Various shellfish farms have experienced the return of fish and much improved environmental conditions just from having the shellfish there. So they're a fairly green form of mariculture and a form that's growing in both in the United States and worldwide.
So does that solve the problem? Stop doing the aquaculture with fish and just concentrate on clams and shellfish. Does that get us where we need to go?
I'm not sure what you mean by where we need to go. It certainly is an improvement. It's certainly better for the oceans if most of the aquaculture went toward the shellfish. It's better on several levels for the oceans. It's equally, for the most part, good protein in terms of food security. They're easier to grow. You don't usually need the antibiotic dosings. You don't need the feeding. So it's not the answer to all food, and we haven't even touched on some of the freshwater species, but tilapia can be a very environmentally benign thing to aquaculture. The Chinese have developed multi-species aquaculture systems where each species occupies a different ecological niche, and so they kind of clean up after each other. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of ways to do it, but in terms of mariculture, I would say stuff you're actually putting in the ocean, shellfish are one of your best bets.
Great. And yet.
And yet.
In your writing, you talk about some potential problems coming down the pike, particularly for shellfish populations. What are those?
Well, shellfish are one of the unfortunate primary victims of climate change's evil twin, as it usually gets called, is ocean acidification. All the carbon dioxide we're pumping into the atmosphere that causes climate change gets, well, not all of it, but a lot of it gets absorbed by the oceans. The oceans are one of the world's biggest carbon dioxide sinks, which is great in terms of keeping climate change from being more runaway than it has been. But they've now absorbed enough carbon dioxide that it's changing the pH of ocean water. Oceans are naturally basic, somewhere around 8.2, 8.4, depending on exactly where you are in the ocean. And when they absorb carbon dioxide, it's a much more complicated chemical reaction than this, but basically the carbon dioxide becomes carbonic acid. And
that's bad.
That's bad for ocean pH.
Maybe I can stop you for a second. Can you just explain pH for those of us who might have been asleep in high school chemistry?
Okay, well, pH is a measure of how many hydrogen or hydroxyl ions you have in a liquid, usually. Ranges from 0 to 14. 7 is neutral, so distilled water is 7. Salt water, like I said, tends to be slightly basic, around 8.2, 8.4. Pretty much our blood, too. Soda pop is acidic, same reaction, carbonic acid. If you've dealt with hydrochloric acid, you're more concentrated hydrochloric acid, more in the 3 to 2 to 1 range, very strong acid, which obviously can burn through skin. So it's on a logarithmic scale, which means that very small changes in numbers is actually a fairly big change in the chemistry. So, for example, one factoid I read recently, it was that if the pH of your blood changed by 0.02 units, which doesn't sound like much of anything, you'd be comatose.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
So
that is context.
That is context for the fact that the average pH of the oceans has changed by 0.1 pH units.
Are we halfway to comatose in our oceans?
Possibly. Maybe a little less than halfway so far. It's kind of hard to tell. But the fact that the pH of the world's oceans have changed in their entirety should be a little scary to everyone. It's a lot of water. Water's very good at buffering chemical reactions, and that's a measurable change. Now, it's worse in some place than other. Like all things with climate change, you can have global averages, but it's going to be more concentrated in some places than others. So, for example, Puget Sound in Washington has gotten kind of a double whammy. They've experienced a change in currents, which is thought to be related to climate change itself. Changes in temperatures and wind patterns have changed the currents off of Washington and Oregon. So they're getting this very powerful upwelling of stuff from the bottom of the ocean. The bottom of the ocean tends to be more acidic than the rest of the ocean because that's where carbon dioxide and other material gathers. When it comes up, it's usually a good thing. That's where the best fisheries tend to be. But in Puget Sound and off the coast of Oregon, it's coming up so strong and so fast, it's making the waters too acidic for shellfish to grow, especially baby shellfish. Puget Sound's been described as the most corrosive seawater in the world. And so about 2005, the hatcheries, the shellfish hatcheries in Puget Sound were experiencing die-offs in the billions, young shellfish billions dying off. And it turned out it was this very acidic water coming into the facilities and killing them. And they had about 5 years of this before they really nailed down what was going on, and to the point where the state of Washington commissioned a blue ribbon committee to come up with a plan to try and deal with it. But shellfish production in Puget Sound, even knowing this and even trying to put in some protections, warnings of when these upwellings are occurring, is shellfish production is still only about up to about 65-75% of what it was before 2005. Oregon, same current problem, same deal. Maine is another place that's already experiencing this. Maine has got what is known as toxic mud because it's so acidic. And it's actually down in the 6.8 range, so it's a huge drop in pH. And shellfish farmers there used to plant baby clams in the muds. They can't do that because it's so acidic, it dissolves them within 24 hours. So, I mean, it's showing, this is a real problem starting to show up for shellfish fisheries. And it's also a problem for coral reefs, which are also the big natural producers of fish for food consumption. So, ocean acidification is an increasing problem for the people who are trying to do the really benign kinds of mariculture.
So we've talked about kind of what's going on in the wild stocks. We've talked about what's going on in aquaculture. You came up with a great solution, which is shellfish. Then you told us that climate change is going to kill off shellfish. Is this the conversation that's happening just among a few ocean geeks and academics? Or is the wider question about how to produce good food stocks out of oceans, be it through natural stocks or be it through kind of commercially produced aquaculture, is that something governments are paying attention to?
Oh, governments are paying attention. A remarkable number of governments and a growing number of governments around the world are putting aquaculture and mariculture into their food security plans. And the range is kind of incredible. The United Kingdom, especially England, is worried about food security. They want aquaculture to supplement where their seafood will be coming from, which, I mean, England's this island nation with this strong history of fishing, and yet it's worried about it. They're doing creative things like trying to figure out how to tie mariculture to their drive to put in offshore renewable energy and wind farms and use the same structures for both endeavors, which is kind of cool if you're into sustainability. Other places that are worried about this, Philippines, worried about its native fisheries, and so putting mariculture in as part of its food security. Coral-driven nations who are losing their coral reefs to a variety of things, pollution, climate change, ocean acidification, are starting to put in mariculture. But also countries you might not think about, like Saudi Arabia, which has a decent-sized population, but no water. They've got nowhere to go with agriculture. And so they've invested in farms in Africa, but they're also looking to do deep water, which is the newest development in mariculture, deep water mariculture in the Arabian Sea. And most interestingly, recently, and something to really think about for the future, is that in October of 2012, Egypt requested the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization to look into some sort of regime for doing mariculture in the high seas, those places beyond national jurisdiction, which places like Hawaii have been experimenting with. There's a really cool, technologically debatable, environmentally, mariculture operation operating in the federal waters, more than 3 miles out to sea, very deep waters off the coast of Hawaii, which is finding some commercial success. So nations that are water-strapped are starting to say, hey, high seas, maybe we can do something out there. And so this is all very real. This is something that nations are actively implementing, actively planning for, looking to expand into new arenas, and it will be a very interesting food security issue for many decades to come.
Well, what are your predictions? I mean, you're watching this area. If you could look 5 or 10 or 20 years into the future, what do you think governments will do? What do you think the state of our fishery stocks will look like?
I am fairly pessimistic about what the state of our wild stocks will look like. I don't think the world will catch on until most everything is, in fact, collapsed. And if you remember or have read about the Canadian cod collapse, It's devastating socially, it's devastating economically, as well as being devastating environmentally. That still hasn't recovered. Not every stock collapse is quite that dire. Some of them can come back with a little care, but human nature being human nature, that would be my prediction, is that the wild stocks probably will be fished to at least commercial collapse, you know, not extinction, but commercial collapse. And I think we are going to see more experiments with deep sea mariculture, especially now that there seems to be a success on the books in Hawaii, which will create opportunities and issues in the international law regime for the high seas, for how to even measure the environmental effects, for how do you keep control of your fish in the high seas, you know, the structures that have been created. Some of them are basically free-floating with radio trackers. And so, you know, what does this do to shipping? What does this do to, you know, naval exercise? I mean, there's a whole host of issues to be explored, but I think that's where it's going to be going. I think more people are going to be experimenting with more species. I hope that we go away from the truly destructive species like shrimp and salmon, but I don't see it stopping. It's been growing phenomenally over the last decade, aquaculture and mariculture both, and I don't see that stopping. We're supposed to have another 2 to 3 billion people by the end of the century, and they got to be fed somehow. So,
do you eat aquaculture raised fish?
I am actually allergic to fish and seafood, which is my contribution to the health of the oceans. So no, I don't eat any of it. Wild mariculture, aquaculture, any of it, no.
Robin Kundis Craig, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Vermont Law School Environmental Hot Topics podcast. We hope you can join us for future podcasts on this channel. For more information about Vermont Law School's environmental programs, including links to talks by experts interviewed here, please visit the Vermont Law School Environmental Law Center page at www.vermontlaw.edu/ELC. This has been Rebecca Purdom for Vermont Law School's Hot Topics podcast. We hope you've enjoyed this program. Mm-hmm.